from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Salon columnist Glenn Greenwald will join us in studio in the next hour to discuss the Occupy Wall Street movement, Wednesday's one-day general strike in Oakland, and his new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Greenwald is a former constitutional and civil rights litigator. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Salon.com contributing writer Glenn Greenwald, who worked for 10 years as a litigator in both federal and state courts and is a constitutional lawyer, is also the author of the New York Times bestsellers How Would a Patriot Act and A Tragic Legacy. The Atlantic named him one of the nation's 25 most influential commentators, and he has published in the New York Times, the LA Times, These Times, and the American Conservative. His most recent book is With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. In it, he argues that the United States has a two-tier justice system, one for the political and financial elites who appear to commit crimes all too often with immunity, and the rest of us who have no such immunity and often, especially in cases involving the powerless, suffer an often stringent version of rule of law. Glenn Greenwald joins us in studio for this morning's second Forum Hour, and we welcome you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Good to have you here. Well, you begin, actually, by talking about Tom Paine and Common Sense, American Law is King, and getting to all the founders, Hamilton, Adams, Jefferson, and so forth. The idea that supremacy of law is good government, and what you say essentially is we don't have good government, we don't have good law, and we don't have a just society.
Indeed. If you look at the founders, it's really quite striking because they believed in inequality, in inequality, in most realms of income inequality, wealth inequality, inequality in power. And what they emphasized was that those inequalities would be just and legitimate only if we were bound by the common set of rules on equal terms, regardless of position, prestige, and power, which is really the definition of the rule of law. And although they violated that in all sorts of obvious and fundamental ways, the fact that they affirmed that principle was sort of the animating principle of American progress, and it's really over the last four decades that we've explicitly repudiated that idea and believe that the more powerful you are, the less likely and just it is that you should be held accountable under the law if you get caught committing crimes.
Well, let me repudiate an idea from the last hour, apparently getting a lot of response that we put too much emphasis, which certainly was not decidedly an intention, on what happened after midnight in Oakland as opposed to the peaceful protests that went on during the day that was amazing in many ways and was pulled off with less than a week. But I want to tie some things together here because you indict our political institutions as illegitimate. And to some extent, this perversion of the rule of law, as you see it, is really a kind of fuel for the whole occupied movement.
I absolutely believe that. And the reason I think that is because in America, for better or for worse, we have been inculcated with the idea that inequality in wealth and income is not just inevitable but even desirable as long as it's fair and just and the byproduct of merit and is legitimate. So, for example, when Steve Jobs dies with $8 billion, very few people begrudge that, even though there's mass joblessness and homelessness and foreclosures and the disappearance of the middle class, because there's a perception that he earned it, that he deserved it, that he invented all kinds of technologies that improve the lives of millions of people around the world. So mere inequality has been existing in the United States for at least several decades on this vast scale and has been exploding, and yet it didn't sustain this protest movement. I think what is the fuel behind the protest movement is the perception, the accurate perception that these inequalities are now illegitimate because it's the byproduct of cheating and protecting ill-gotten gains through co-opting the political and legal institutions that were supposed to ensure a fair playing field.
The Occupy movement is against an unequal system, in effect, as you're saying. Yeah.
Well, I think that it's not – I don't think it's a socialist movement – On the whole, there probably are individual components of it that would identify that way. But I don't think it's about demanding that there be a mass transfer of wealth so that everybody is on purely equal terms and in sense of outcomes or wealth or inequality. I think the anger is that the very people who have collapsed our financial system and destroyed economic security were the same people who pilfered and plundered and profited as a result of their crimes rather than being held accountable for them. So the equality that is being demanded is not one of pure outcome equality, but of equality in how we're treated before the law and the rules and the way in which our political institutions govern. And I think that's really the equality that the movement is demanding.
Well, as a filmmaker who made Inside Job, who appeared on this program soon after he won the Academy Awards and said publicly, there is no one who has been held accountable, no one has gone to jail. That still is the case, of course.
That is absolutely the case. And what's particularly amazing about that is there's no question that the financial crisis was the byproduct of systematic criminal fraud, the kind of fraud for which millions of people have been indicted and prosecuted and put into prison when they're not the head of Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs. Even Alan Greenspan, whose career was devoted to serving as an apologist for Wall Street and a servant for its interests, testified before Congress and said one reason that the financial crisis happened was because our free market philosophy has been proven wrong, but a very substantial reason why it happened is because there was just outright fraud on the part of these large institutions, the credit agencies that rated these toxic instruments as high-grade debt. And it's the kind of fraud representing things to the public that you know to be false that the criminal laws were designed to prohibit and punish, and yet nobody has been punished by virtue of that conduct even 3.5 years later while the world still hasn't recovered.
This is something that's made me very indignant, and a boyhood friend of mine who was a prosecutor for the DOJ, I said to him, can't you bring some of these people to the bar of justice through RICO? And I mean, is it so political? Are they protected by politics? He said, no, they're protected by the fact that it's very difficult to prosecute. It's difficult to prosecute because the RICO laws make it more difficult to prosecute.
Well, you know, there's a lot of difficult prosecutions. Most prosecutions are difficult. If you prosecute a murder case, if you prosecute any kind of financial fraud case, these involve lots of resources, and the defendants, if they're rich, are going to have large teams of lawyers. But what's so important about the crimes that have been insulated from accountability over the past decade, the creation of the worldwide torture regime, spying on Americans without warrants, the illegal attack on Iraq, and especially these financial crimes, is that these are the most significant crimes that can be created. I mean, if you look at the people who are in prison in the United States, the crimes that they committed are far less serious in terms of the impact and destruction and devastation than these financial crimes that precipitated this crisis or mortgage fraud scandals. And yet, to insulate those crimes because, well, it's just kind of complex and difficult, is really inexcusable. That's why we have a Justice Department filled with thousands of lawyers, is to figure this out and figure out how to hold even the highest powered criminals accountable.
You go back in some ways to, well, Watergate and to Nixon not being prosecuted, given a pardon, and the pardons followed for people like Cap Weinberger and so forth. I mean, that kind of set a certain kind of tone in your mind?
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, it's not new that people who are rich and powerful have advantages in our legal system. That's been true since the day the country was founded. But what is new is that if you watch Gerald Ford go on television to try and justify to a very angry and skeptical American citizenry why the most powerful political official, whom we've always taught is not above the law, would be pardoned and never see the inside of a courtroom when he got caught committing huge amounts of crimes, Ford is very kind of shifty-eyed. He's almost embarrassed. He knows that what he's doing is shameful and wrong. And what he says is, when he addresses the nation, is, of course, I believe in the rule of law. The rule of law is no respecter of persons, he said, which is the crux of this principle. But then he then added this sort of newly concocted amendment. He said, but the rule of law is a respecter of reality, meaning if it's too disruptive or too divisive to hold the most powerful people accountable, then in the name of the common good, we should simply look forward and move on. And this kind of Orwellian idea that it's in the common good to protect the most powerful people from consequences when they commit crimes was then, as you said, the one that took root, and it then justified protecting Iran-Contra criminals from all accountability, and now the crimes of the Bush era as well, and then into the private sector where we saw the telecom industry immunized when they broke the law in helping the Bush administration spy on us without warrants, and now Wall Street criminals as well.
So no one is above the law unless it hurts the Republic from the Republic power point of view.
Right. And unless the people, where a nation of law is not men, unless the men running the country decide that the law shouldn't apply.
Well, there is a kind of ideal that we have nonetheless, that equity in face of the law, or no one is above the law, as I said. And yet, the suggestion is that money and politics play too preeminent a role and always have played too preeminent a role. As you said earlier, I mean, if you could afford, you know, a dream team like OJ, then you could get a dream team defending you and maybe get off for a murder you might have been guilty of. That's always been
right
involved in our system. But you're talking about something that goes beyond that. You're talking about something that's inimical to essentially fairness and justice and equity, period.
Well, the issue has been in the past that if you are powerful and or rich and are indicted and then prosecuted, you will have a much better legal team than someone who's poor. And even especially now, where if you're an indigent criminal defendant charged with a felony that can send you to prison for decades, you will have a public defender who in some counties in the country is able to spend an average of 7 minutes on your case talking to you to sort out your options and decide what it is that you want to do in defense of yourself. So this disparity exists, but it's always existed. What has changed is two things. One is, as I just said, we now explicitly advocate the idea that the powerful shouldn't be held accountable under the law. We reject the principle of the rule of law, both in practice and in words. And that is a fairly radical change. And then the other aspect of it is, if this leniency were applied across the board to all Americans or ordinary Americans, regardless of position, you could have a debate about whether or not leniency was the right criminal justice approach, but at least it would be fair. But we do the opposite with ordinary Americans. We imprison more of our citizens than any other country in the world by far, including countries that have lots more people in them. We imprison them for more trivial transgressions for longer periods of time and with less mercy and forgiveness and the opportunity of parole than any country in the Western world. So the world that exists in the terms of justice for ordinary Americans is the exact opposite of the immunity and leniency we give to elites. And that's the core of the rule of law problem.
We're talking again with Glenn Greenwald. His book is With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. There's a kind of trickle down, you should forgive the language here, in this. I remember talking to prisoners who would say, you know, politicians are corrupt and they're doing unlawful things, so why shouldn't I be violating the law? And why am I getting punished when they're not getting punished? And there's a sense of just that hypocrisy that runs through particularly those who are part of the 99% or whatever and wind up serving time. I'm also struck by the fact that you indict the press in this. You feel that the press plays kind of an integral role.
If you look, for example, what happened with Watergate, poll showed Americans largely opposed to the Nixon pardon, and yet the leaders of advocating for its validity and its justness were essentially media stars who were virtually unanimous in defending the pardon. And since then, what you've seen is every time there are high-level crimes committed by political officials or financial elites, it's the media that takes the lead role in arguing against investigations. We even saw this at the beginning of the Obama presidency when large majorities of Americans, most people don't know this, but large majorities of Americans in poll after poll wanted investigations to determine whether or not the Bush interrogation program, the Bush eavesdropping program, the U.S. attorney firing, whether those were illegal and whether there should be accountability. And yet, almost unanimously, you would listen to television or read in the newspapers journalists and media figures who claim to be the watchdog class over those people in political power, demanding that there be no investigations, arguing that it would be too divisive, too disruptive, that we should move on. It's because the media class has become servants to those in power, spokespeople for them, and not adversarial to them or watchdogs over them. And that's why they are often the lead advocates in demanding this impunity for the most powerful people.
I'm hearing Chomsky here.
Well, it's just interestingly, you know, if there are things that people like Noam Chomsky used to say 20 years ago that made him radical and fringe that you can now see being said in the most mainstream circles. I mean, you could pick up the New York Times and read Nicholas Kristof saying that the United States has become a banana republic. It's a third world country. The most amazing article was this article in The Atlantic by Simon Johnson, who was once the chief economist of the IMF. You can't get more mainstream or establishment than that. And he called this article The Quiet Coup, and it talked about how oligarchs have taken over American democracy and is completely captive to this tiny sliver of special interest. So you don't even have to be Noam Chomsky anymore to make those glaringly obvious observations.
Well, you've been pretty consistent on the points you're making here. For example, you take somewhat to task the American government for drone attacks in the sense of citizens, in fact, innocent citizens being killed by the drone attacks, which is a form of murder. You were on board with those who felt Alaki, who is an American citizen, shouldn't have been killed. But of course, you may be going against the grain here. I mean, there are many people who feel these are our enemies. They have to be taken out, especially someone like Alaki, who is responsible for clearly a lot of the terrorist acts that were attempted, and some of them abortive at that, but many, including the one, of course, at Fort Hood, that he inspired or that he was a main catalyst for. And yet the consistency on your part is obey the law and be accountable for disobeying the law.
Well, the foundation of the American system by design is that we don't trust leaders to exercise power in the dark and without checks and balances.
I mean, even if it's in our security interest.
Especially if it's in our security interest, because oftentimes that's where the most abuse occurs. So nobody opposes the ability of the U.S. government to punish people who are actually involved in terrorist attacks. But the argument, which is central to who we are as a country, is that we don't allow the president to target our fellow citizens for death, for assassination, without forcing him to present evidence in some other body, like a court, that the person that he wants to kill is actually guilty of anything. And yet we've seen the U.S. government assert the power to assassinate our fellow citizens, to detain them without charges. It's essentially the most radical powers that could possibly be asserted. It's pure lawlessness to allow a political leader to target people for detention, for surveillance, for death, without any transparency, without any checks or balances, without any due process of any kind.
Even if we are, as certainly many of those who did essentially what we're talking about here say, we're in a war. I mean, it may not be a declared war. Congress may not have declared a war legally, but we are in a war against terrorism.
Well, first of all, I think that's a disputable issue. And one of the interesting things was it was once Democratic Party dogma. In 2004, John Kerry famously said that the reason we've run amok in how we reacted to 9/11 is because instead of treating it like what it is, which is a criminal problem, we're treating it like a war. So this was once the Republican position that we have to have that we have to look at it as a war. The entire world is a battlefield, and the president is the commander in chief who has to be unrestrained in the powers that he asserted. Of course, lots of Democrats say that now that a Democratic president is in office, but it's a very radical position to describe the entire world as a battlefield, that it doesn't matter if Congress declares war or not. I mean, traditionally, the way you kill combatants in war is that there's a battlefield and someone is shooting at you and you're then entitled to shoot back at them and kill them. That's not the situation.
You go after a sovereign state because of but we were attacked by not a sovereign state. We were attacked by – I mean, the whole argument at the time was, police action. This is an unlawful act. We go after it in police action. But we saw a whole state under the Taliban was giving essentially sanctuary to those who attacked us.
Well, but the Taliban was actually the leader of Afghanistan. And so we invaded that country, and that became a conventional war where there's a battlefield where there are fighters who are shooting at our troops and our troops then shoot back. That's the traditional battlefield model where people are killed without due process because they're on an active battlefield. That's completely different than what we're doing in Pakistan and in Somalia and in Yemen, where people are being targeted while in their homes with their children, riding cars with friends, at work. They're being targeted for death. They're not shooting at anybody. They're not on a battlefield. They're far away from a war zone. And yet the president is sending basically sky robots based solely on his say-so that these people are guilty and shooting Hellfire missiles at them and extinguishing their lives along with anybody else who happens to be near them. That really is an act of murder, of assassination that has nothing to do with war or battlefield.
So the solution for Glenn Greenwald, follow the law to the letter of the law and be accountable if you don't follow the law.
Right. If the United States government believes that a citizen has actually engaged in treason or other acts of terrorism, go to a court, indict him, present evidence of his guilt, convict him, and then punish him in accordance with the law, not based on this tyrannical power that the president can act as judge, jury, and executioner.
And what about solution for what those who are out protesting? I mean, on the one hand, as I said earlier, we talked about a peaceful protest and how many people were exhilarated by the movement down to close the port during the day. And then after the fall of night, unfortunate events occurred. And there are many who are saying this is the only way, of course, to defeat the system. Some of those who ran amok. And then you hear all the arguments back and forth about, it was a peaceful protest, but what did it accomplish? Got all these people out there in great numbers. Strength in numbers, solidarity, et cetera. Wouldn't have been better to take your money out of the banks, put it in a credit union, that sort of thing. I mean, we're talking about tactics here. And what are the best tactics as you see?
Well, I think broadly speaking, there are two ways to effectuate political change. You can work within political and legal institutions, work for candidates, give money to political parties, canvass for votes and the like. And the problem is once there's a perception that political and legal institutions have become radically corrupted and no longer offer the prospect for meaningful change, then the only viable alternative becomes working outside of the system to create this movement of dissent.
dissent, which is why, for example, the changes that occurred as part of the Arab Spring weren't from electing leaders because they didn't have that option. Their institutions were corrupted. They went to the street and demanded change. And I think that's
what happened
we're
in Wisconsin, too.
Yeah. And oftentimes that's legitimate. And I mean, Martin Luther King taught that that's often the case and the only just alternative, you know. And I think that the movement has already achieved a great deal. For one thing, you now have, instead of the political media class obsessed with the idea of austerity and cutting social programs and government spending as a means of redressing the financial crisis, you have them talking about the huge, massive income inequality that exists in the United States and the harm that comes from it. So just injecting that idea into the mainstream discourse is a huge success, as is putting a little bit of fear in the hearts of political and financial elites. I mean, that is important, that people who govern and exercise power have fear about what will happen if they cross lines and abuse their power. And I think that fear has been lacking almost completely, which is why the elite classes have been running amok. So reinstituting the idea that there are lines that they cannot cross without triggering meaningful citizen unrest and dissent and outrage, I think is a very important thing.
Again, we're talking to Glenn Greenwald, his new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some. You can join us and are cordially invited to do so. Our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, you can call us now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have and join the conversation by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. And, of course, you can also join us on Facebook, on our Facebook page. Here's Dave, who writes, "Being a Wall Streeter, I can tell you that the rating agencies were fools and dupes, but they weren't involved in fraud. Very little of what Wall Street was doing was illegal, improper, or immoral, just plain reckless. Yes, but seldom illegal, especially since the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Millions of ordinary homeowners and their small-times mortgage salespeople did engage in fraud. Not for nothing were Alta loans called liar loans. This fraud was widespread and also very easy to prosecute and prove. Why is your guest silent on this?"
Right. That's just not true. And I'll tell you why it's not true. It is true that investment banks and the securities industry has exercised great control over the political system in both political parties. The Democrats in the 1990s decided they would be funded by Wall Street. They put people into positions of power in the financial realm of government, like Larry Summers and Robert Rubin, who were essentially acolytes of Wall Street, and they did abolish.
They were the same people that were appointed in the Obama administration
to fix
after
the
they
problem.
Worked in the Bush administration.
Absolutely true. And it is true that there was this deregulation, this deregulation orgy in the 90s where Wall Street basically abolished a lot of the restraints that had been in place for many decades to prevent another depression. They used their control over the government, of the political process, to just abolish the laws they didn't want to abide by any longer. So that part is true. What's untrue is that they didn't have any idea that the instruments were toxic. There are all kinds of emails that have been discovered in credit agencies explicitly acknowledging that the prospect for default was extremely high within these derivative products at the same time that they were rating them top grade. The same is true in investment banks, who were betting against the very products that they were selling to their customers and representing as being sound investment instruments. They had knowledge that what they were doing was misrepresenting the quality of these products because there was an incentive for them to do that because that's how they made bonuses and large amounts of money. And at the same time, they thought that the bubble would continuously inflate. So much of this was sort of legalized crime, to use that paradoxical phrase, because they just changed the laws they didn't want. But the laws against fraud are very clear and very strong, and they were clearly violated in all sorts of ways.
We're coming up on a break, and I don't know if you have the answer to this question, but it's come up before, and maybe a quick response from you. The corporations who feel threatened by Occupy Wall Street are probably getting very nervous, as you said, about how long it's going to last. You think that some of the troublemakers in New York City and Oakland are, in fact, planted plainclothes agent provocateurs? I think it's likely, says this.
I mean, if that weren't the case, it would be the first time ever that there was a protest movement that the government didn't infiltrate. So I think it's safe to assume some of them are.
Talking again with Glenn Greenwald, we'll continue with your calls and emails. His new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Salon columnist Glenn Greenwald here with us in studio discussing Occupy Wall Street movement, the one-day general strike in Oakland, and his new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Here's a comment from a listener on the web. I'm really happy to hear Glenn Greenwald on this hour. I went to see him last night, but the talk was sold out. Well, it was free, so it wasn't technically sold out, but it was in a pretty small room and people had to be turned away. I don't know if it's sold out tonight, but if it's not, you can actually see Glenn in Berkeley. He'll be at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30 this evening, and he will be there. Whether or not there are tickets left, I don't know. Another web comment: thank you for finally having an intelligent, honest journalist on the show. Please make frequent use of Greenwald. He's a national treasure. Okay, feel good when you get those comments, don't you? Yeah, nice. Of course you should. Okay, let's get some calls in. Dan, hi, you're on.
Hi. So first of all, I want to say it's an honor to be speaking to Glenn Greenwald and to have him on KQED. It really is an honor. You often make me angry when I read your stuff, but it's right on, and I read it all the time. And so, thank you.
Thank you.
My questions are: first of all, I do feel like you have some contradictory positions about, you know, your claims about media complicity and all this. Because on the one hand, you say the media is complicit, but on the other hand, you do sort of mention Kristof and The Atlantic, and I mean, it does seem like there's plenty of media that even sources you draw from that do expose this stuff and do sort of contradict the politicians' narrative on what's going on. So I'm interested in kind of whether you agree with my statement about your contradiction or not. And then the second part of this is, there is, I mean, even if you discount the mainstream media and just look at like blogs and new media and Salon and all these, I mean, there does seem to be a lot more exposure about these kind of abuses going on. And yet at the same time, it seems like these abuses are getting more widespread and bigger. And so that's very weird to me. Like, why is it that as a country we don't seem to be, you know, getting the benefits of this new media exposure to these abuses?
Yeah, those are two great questions. As far as the first one is concerned, when you talk about media behavior, you're never talking in absolute terms. So, of course, when you talk, for example, about the way in which the media has become subservient to political power, you can find exceptions, many exceptions, to people who have exposed government secrets and yet who work at major media outlets. But what I'm really talking about is not people like, say, Nicholas Kristof or Simon Johnson in The Atlantic diagnosing the problem. What I'm talking about is something much more specific, which is whether or not they believe that politically powerful officials should be investigated and prosecuted when they get caught committing crimes on equal terms with ordinary Americans in the way that they're punished. And that, I think, is extremely rare to find anybody who, for example, advocated that there be investigations and prosecutions of Bush officials for torture, illegal eavesdropping, the attack on Iraq. That, I think, is really an orthodoxy among the media class. The second issue about how there are all these alternative sites and yet these abuses continue, you're absolutely right. And I think the problem there is that there's a huge chasm between public opinion and the political class. Public opinion has very little influence on the political class because they are essentially captive to very small slivers of wealthy interest, and that's why public opinion makes little difference.
Let me thank the caller. You kind of make the point in your book that the high-profile cases that are prosecuted, the sensational cases like Blagojevich or Madoff, are really the exception. But there are a lot of people high up who are getting – I mean, recently, in fact, Goldman Sachs prosecution they're particularly inside trading, those sorts
right.
of things?
Yeah, you can find – again, these are not absolute terms. You can also find now and then some ordinary Americans who receive leniency in the court system. Generally, when elites, financial elites, are held accountable under the law, it's because either they become so extreme in their criminal behavior that you can't let it go on any longer because it's just too brazen. Or number two is that the grievance are themselves people in power. So for example, Louis Libby got prosecuted even though he was Dick Cheney's top aide, but that's because it was the CIA demanding the prosecution because he had exposed one of their agents. And so what you can see is even in the exceptions, it sort of proves the rule. But these are not absolute rules. These are trends and developments that I think are close to absolute, though.
You're the first person I've heard call him Lewis instead of Scooter.
I don't like that nickname for him. It's too friendly.
Let me get some more calls on here. Jeff is joining us. Jeff, you're on.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think that the your intellectual argument would be greatly strengthened if we heard out here, particularly us that happen to be more conservative, and it is about a 50-50 split in this country, maybe even more. There are a divide. We do have a divided nation in terms of philosophy. We have a lot of unification points and unifying points, but there are half of us that might disagree with the traditional leftist slant. And your intellectual argument would be greatly strengthened if we heard more about Clinton and the pardons of Mark Rich, and we heard more about Obama actually being the captain of Wall Street and taking more money than anybody else before. Clinton before that, more corporate money came in terms of donations to him. I think it would be greatly strengthened if we heard examples of the kind of abuse of power that you're talking about equally doled out and shown to all of us from both sides of the aisle. As it is right now, you just sound very partisan.
Yeah, well, I mean,
your argument is greatly weakened.
Actually, if you look at anything that I've ever written, including the book that I've just released, what you'll find is exactly what you just requested. In fact, the book only has five chapters. One of the five is devoted almost exclusively to examining the influences that Wall Street and the corporate class exert over the Obama administration and the way in which President Obama filled his top positions with servants of Wall Street in the securities industry. And then a second chapter of the five is devoted to the way in which the Obama administration shielded Bush officials from the consequences of their crime as a way of ensuring that that lawbreaking license would be available to them. I've also written extensively about the sleazy and horrendous pardon of Mark Rich, in which Eric Holder played a central role. And so all the things that you're demanding that I talk about are all valid examples, and that's why I talk about them quite a bit.
But let me go back to the caller just for a minute, Jeff. What you were hearing here today, though, Nixon, Iran-Contra seemed to be partisan in your mind, and mainly Iraq War clustered around Republican?
Yeah, absolutely. And furthermore, you know, the Occupy Wall Street jokers do not represent 99% of us. They do not represent at least 60% of Americans. And why are they not protesting? They're protesting tuition hikes. Why are they not protesting professors who, because of tenure, contribute to the greatest rises in tuition? Number one, why are they not protesting President Obama?
I mean, you know, it's interesting that you like to accuse other people of seeing the world through a partisan prism. What sounds to me is that you are trying to actually put what is a movement that is not very partisan into this prism that you want others to avoid. The Occupy movement has protested President Obama. They had marched on the White House. The movement in Iowa went to his campaign appearance in Des Moines and protested outside. There are people who are in the movement who are far from on the left side of the spectrum, lots of libertarians and conservatives who are just as angry about the co-option of our institutions by elites. And polls show that large pluralities of Americans who have heard about the Occupy movement support it and share its views, because it isn't only liberals or people on the left who are angry about the tilted playing field and the way in which the middle class is disappearing. So I think the one who needs to get rid of the partisan prism sounds to me a little bit like it's you.
Let me thank Jeff for the call and go to some web comments here, kind of contrasting comments. Here's one who says, every branch of the government is broken. The judicial branch is becoming completely corrupted. The Congress is completely corrupted by lobbyist money and corporate influence. The executive branch is often helpless or worse, headed by a crook, such as was the case with Nixon and others like him. The only way to fix these things is by radical change, ASAP. This is what the Occupy movement is about. Another listener writes, your guests and many other commentators mistakenly conflate two different events. Income inequality has developed over 30-plus years and can be attributed to globalization, education, lack of trade policy, etc. Wall Street, not really. The current recession was certainly exacerbated by Wall Street excesses, and there should be re-regulation and punishment where appropriate. To conflate these two, Wall Street caused our economic woes, is simplistic and misleading and is, I believe, a major messaging problem from Occupy Wall Street.
Well, I mean, I think Wall Street is as much of a symbol as anything else, because what has happened is there are huge numbers of people on Wall Street who have presided over very poor performance and yet continue to take home $20 million a year in pay. We just saw John Corzine, who ran his firm into the ground, had many hundreds of millions of dollars missing and is about to receive a mandated $12 million severance. So Wall Street is more the symbol than the cause, but they are a very powerful symbol, because what they symbolize is pilfering and plundering that gets rewarded rather than punished. And I think that's why it provokes so many people's ire.
And we'll bring some more callers on. Josh, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. My question was sort of in regards to what we were talking about earlier about due process of law for the people that we're going after in Pakistan or Somalia or those types of countries. I don't disagree with you. I mean, I'm an attorney. I understand due process, and I think that it's essential to the way that our government, our judicial system works. But how would it actually work in practice? I mean, let's take Al-Awlaki, for example. The government brings a case against him here in the U.S. He doesn't show up. He's convicted in absentia, and then we have this conviction that doesn't really mean anything because he didn't really provide a defense because he's not going to come here. And then is that okay for us to go after him at that point? Or I'm just trying to figure out like how your theory would actually work in practice.
Well, I mean, I think that you know we have statutes under the our U.S. code that make terrorism a crime. Lots of people have been prosecuted for it. And, of course, the Constitution imposes heightened requirements for how you have to convict somebody of treason. So if you indict Anwar al-Awlaki, you can then go to Yemen and instead of – we obviously knew where he was to kill him. Instead of doing that, you work with the Yemeni government, which is our client state, and you apprehend him the way we've apprehended thousands of people from countless countries around the world as part of the war on terror and brought them to Guantanamo. Instead of bringing them to Guantanamo, you bring them to a U.S. court on U.S. soil. If for some reason you can't find him, then he's basically a fugitive. And we don't have the right to just hunt down fugitives and murder them. The way that you treat fugitives is by going and trying to find them. I mean, even Nazi war criminals were given trials at Nuremberg. They could have been, and lots of people wanted to, take them out back and just shot in the head summarily.
The Israelis kidnapped Adolf Eichmann from Argentina, right.
And brought him back to Israel. They didn't kill him, and he was responsible for some of the most heinous Nazi war crimes.
Well, they executed him. I mean, he was the only
after a trial. After a trial. Right. And I think that's the issue, is they presented their evidence to the world and proved his guilt and only then meted out punishment. That's Western justice.
Should Holder have gone ahead with his initial plan to have held trials in New York City?
Absolutely. I mean, this was one of the principal promises of the Obama campaign in 2008 was we were going to abide by the rule of law in our treatment of terrorism. Holder really wanted to. He announced it. Really, what he should have done is resign because it was White House pressure for political reasons that forced him to change what his original prosecution plan was.
I think it may have been Bloomberg pressure on the White House, don't you think?
Yeah, but then the White House – I mean, the idea is, as we recall from the Alberto Gonzalez and Karl Rove scandals of the Bush years, the Justice Department is the one agency that's supposed to be insulated from political pressure. It's the law enforcement branch of government. It's supposed to deal with justice, and it's supposed to be independent and apoliticized. That was the scandal of the Bush administration was firing U.S. attorneys for political reasons. We shouldn't accept those kind of prosecution decisions being made, not based on legal considerations and consideration of justice, but through White House pressure.
Again, our guest is Glenn Greenwald. His book is With Liberty and Justice for Some, and our next caller from Houston, Texas, David, join us. You're on.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
So, you know, I guess my question to you is, first of all, I'm a veteran. My five brothers all served in the service. I come from a family that's given 170 years of military service in just two generations, from World War II up to the current conflict. And I agree with everything you're saying. I do. I think that our government's out of control. My question for you is, would you better enunciate the differences between the parties? Because from where I'm standing, I don't really see one. I see the progressives accepting just as much corporate dollars or PAC money as the conservatives, and I see the influence equally. I really, when I look at Congress or the House of Representatives, I don't see two parties. I see one institution that is essentially a money-making machine.
David, thank you for all your family service, but thank you also for that question. I want to dovetail it with a web comment here that says, regarding the press supporting the powered elites regarding Nixon and Bush, does Mr. Greenwald see the same support for Democratic presidents, such as Clinton and Obama? My perception is the Democratic presidents are perpetually facing witch hunts in the media. So along the same lines, do you see the separation? They're both money politicked up to the eyeballs of Democrats and Republicans.
Right. I mean, I think the protest movement is about, and even the Tea Party movement to some extent, was more about this issue than any other, the idea that you can vote for either candidate, but they end up captive to the same interests. So Obama and Democrats often love to rail against Wall Street and fat cats, and yet they funded his political campaign in 2008.
Well, forgive me, but how many of these young people are out there because they were promised change by the Obama administration, change that they thought was going to be systemic?
I mean, that I think is exactly right. I mean, the Obama campaign purposely targeted people who were cynical and had decided that the political process wasn't worth being involved in. That was what Yes We Can and the Audacity of Hope were all about. They promised them, look, put that aside, that cynicism, and put your faith in this political campaign. And if we win, you will get the change that you so desperately crave, that you believe
hasn't been available in politics. And lots of people believed it. They poured their money and time and energy and hope into that campaign only to see that Wall Street continued to thrive, that political criminals were insulated and that middle class continued to disappear. And I think that has ironically increased huge amounts of cynicism more than ever existed before the Obama campaign, because people think, well, if it didn't change here, it never will. And I think that's why you see them taking to the streets instead of the ballot box.
So you go along with maybe the Nader view, Dems, Republicans, not many hairs of difference, because traditionally Democrats have been more pro-labor. Republicans are opposed to tax hikes of any kind. I mean, there are clearly fissures.
There definitely are differences. There are differences in social issues that keep the sort of parties strengthened in terms of the people who are loyal to them. There are some minor differences in financial policy. But what, you know, I think is largely true is that whether they're good intent, well-intentioned or malignantly intentioned, the same permanent power factions in Washington, the lobbyist class, the financial class, the permanent national security state, continue to get their way, and whatever politician you elect serves their interest, are captive to them, notwithstanding the minor differences between them. And I guess it's up to everyone's own conscience to decide whether those minor differences justify caring about the outcome, or whether or not the more effective and advisable thing to do is to challenge the political culture as a whole and demand more radical change within it.
More of your calls. David, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. You're on.
Yeah. How are you? You know, I've you had an earlier caller, and he was trying to ride you about the pardon of I've forgotten Rich's last name from the Clinton administration. If I remember right, that fellow that was pardoned, Scooter Libby, was his attorney. So you could have saved a lot of arguing around by just giving him a pure example of that. You know, I wanted to raise the issue of other civilizations being collapsed like this before. It's my understanding that ancient Rome was collapsed because of cronyism, the idea of outsourcing all of the jobs, and essentially, I'm just wondering if you can show any living examples, historical examples of other civilizations being collapsed by organized crime or by these if cronyism, it seems to me, is actually kind of a light term in comparison to what it truly is, which is organized crime, which just essentially loots a nation and then snags up the spoils at auction prices. So I'm wondering if you want to, you know, elucidate on that.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I would answer it this way. If you look at what the founders' writings are on the question of the supremacy of the rule of law and the reason why it's so imperative, they were obviously historically aware to a great extent, and talked about how the one anchor that prevents a society from decaying within is to make certain that even the most powerful people, or really especially the most powerful people, operate within constraints, because the minute constraints are removed, they are free to cause extreme corruption, to pilfer and to steal, to create the society as a kleptocracy, to exercise power tyrannically. That was what they were most angry about in terms of the British king, the idea that his minions and cronies could be exempt from law. They talked about empires, how it has fallen in the past, and identified the fact that really it's because power can be exercised without serious limitations, and law was intended to be that limitation in America.
Supremacy of law is good government, as you say in your book, and the absence of it is bad government.
Precisely.
And some more comments from listeners. Catherine writes, Glenn, I was introduced to your blog by one of your great champions and my favorite author, Barry Eisler. It's great to hear you on Forum. Thank you for the work you do. Sonia in Berkeley says, one first step the big financial institutions and corporations can take is to abolish the obscene bonuses that their CEOs receive each year. News that they are actually taking that step would go a long way to appeasing the outrage of us members of the 99%. And here's another listener who says, even though I am opposed to violence and protesting and enjoyed my experience yesterday at the Oakland protest because it was peaceful and positive, I'd like to point out how the Vietnam War protest started out nonviolent and continued onto the violent side. No matter how violent the protest got, the leaders and pro-war citizens never seemed to understand how wrong they were to support the war. How do we get people in charge of ruining the economy to get it?
I think the protest movement is one important answer. If you know, you engage in all kinds of abuse of power and extreme corruption and nobody seems to mind, you're not going to conclude that there's anything wrong or you have a reason to stop. I think they need to be given a reason, a real tangible reason to stop. And seeing that citizens will no longer tolerate it is, as far as I'm concerned, the only way to really achieve that.
Another listener writes, Michael, I'd like to elaborate on your guest's idea that there are two tiers to American justice and say that there are several tiers. At the bottom is the non-white poor, to whom virtually anything can be done in the name of law and order. Then come the white poor, then the middle class, and so on. You cannot understand the legal system in this country until you acknowledge the realities of race and class and the way our citizens tacitly condone different treatment.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I have a substantial section in the book on how the drug war is racist, how if you're poor and black, then your treatment is going to be even worse than just ordinary Americans who are powerless but white. And there's even a lower class, which are people accused of terrorism, citizens or any other kind, accused of terrorism, who don't even receive the pretense of due process. They can be imprisoned or killed without due process of any kind. So it's true there are multi-tiers based on who you are, which is the exact opposite of what the rule of law was supposed to be.
We bring in another caller, and that's you, Ronan. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. How are you guys?
Doing okay. Thank
Great.
You.
Great. My question is –
I shouldn't speak for both of us. Are you doing okay, Glenn?
I'm doing very well as okay. well. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear. Anyway, my question is everyone knows, you know, in America that, you know, our political system is corrupted by the private industry, and it's so blatantly obvious. You know, and we have discussions about it, and we have, you know, these forums, and, you know, it's always open to discussion, but for some reason, you know, the relationship never gets, it's never addressed. It never gets changed. I mean, what can we do to actually, you know, change the relationship between our government and our private industry? I mean, they have so much control over our government and the policies they make. I mean, it's so obvious that it's happening, but I mean, we need a solution. There has to be a retooling of that relationship, and I just wondered if you could speak to that. I'll take my answer
up.
Well,
thank you for that question. Of course, we keep hearing real campaign finance reform. I mean, that seems to be the answer that many almost knee-jerk come up with, but we haven't seen anything like it or even resembling
well,
it.
Well, this is the problem is, you know, and this reminds me of the beginning stages of the Occupy movement when media figures and other people, well-intentioned critics, kept saying, you know, what are your specific legislative demands? And the problem is you can come up with legislative solutions. For example, I think that a system of public financing where a candidate who's running against somebody who receives millions of dollars from industry will receive millions of dollars as well from this public financing fund and will even the playing field. The problem is that the reason that's not going to happen is precisely because the system is corrupted. Why would the people in power benefiting from the way things are want to enact laws that will undermine their own position? They won't. And ever since I've been writing about politics, that question, you know, what is it that we can do about these things is the one that I get most frequently asked. And one of the reasons why I'm so ecstatic about the Occupy movement and find it inspiring is because it provides an answer to that question. It is the answer to that question. It doesn't necessarily mean that it in itself, the way the protest movement is manifesting, is the exact answer. There are better ways to do it, perhaps. There are ways that it will improve and grow. But the real answer is that when citizens feel that they can no longer effectuate change through the political process because it's become radically corrupted, then they always have not just the right, but I think the duty to start demanding change and refusing to accept it by things like marching, disrupting, engaging in social unrest. We've seen it time and time again that that's brought about just results, often more quickly and more thoroughly than working within a corrupted system. And so I think it's providing the template for how that's done.
I was struck when Lawrence Lessig was here, whose work I'm sure you're familiar
mm-hmm,
with,
course.
Just the other week, and he was talking about how this sort of populist rage might actually not only create some serious and potentially profound change, but he was actually advocating the possibility of having every citizen get a voucher to contribute, no other contributions other than what you as an individual citizen want to contribute.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean,
those kind of innovative ideas.
Yeah, I think Lessig has done, you know, it's amazing because he was a Harvard professor. He was a very good friend of President Obama. He was wildly enthusiastic about his 2008 campaign and has become very radicalized by the process that we described earlier where of disillusionment. And he is talking about the kinds of radical changes to our political system that I think are necessary to weed out what really has become an oligarchy. I mean, it's not comfortable to talk about the United States in those terms, but that is absolutely what we have. And it's not going to be fixed by small modifications.
More of your calls. We go next to Berkeley. Anu, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for this program. It's an excellent program. And I wanted to press Mr. Greenwald a little bit more on the issue of, as he put it, I think, creating fear in the hearts of people who need to be scared straight, potentially. While I agree with that, I'm also concerned that myself included, it puts some fear in the hearts of people who want to support and participate. And it's certainly, in my case, I have not wanted to physically participate in Occupy Oakland, although I've followed it very actively in other ways, because I have a small child and I really don't feel comfortable taking her down there, and I would have to. So how might a movement like this address such a line of between necessary fear and counterproductive fear and govern that?
Yeah, it's an important question. And look, I'm not somebody who romanticizes social unrest or protest or revolution or anything like that. You know, I think one should advocate it very, very reluctantly. Even things like street protests, exactly for the reason that you're saying, that when you have citizens trying to effectuate change through these sort of outside of the system means, it becomes very unpredictable. It's inflammatory and volatile. It can even be itself dangerous. But I think the status quo is so unsustainable and it's self-dangerous, really leading to the kind of societal collapse and national collapse that we've read about in other countries and thought we were immune from, that I think those kind of extreme options are warranted. And there are lots of ways to support this protest besides physically going down there and participating. You could participate in ones that are a little bit more tranquil than the one in Oakland. You can donate winter clothing to some of the northern cities that need it, because that's going to be the key test for whether it endures. I think there's lots of ways citizens will become involved, but it is risky. There's going to be lots of increasing police responses as a way of signaling, deterring to people that they cannot protest without being met with force. And
it's also going to be a lot of bad weather ahead. I mean,
yeah, that's why there's a campaign underway that a liberal blog, Fire Dog Lake, started today to basically donate clothing and blankets and hats. I was in Occupy Boston last week and was scheduled to speak, and there was a blizzard and it got canceled. That's the challenge of the movement right now.
Do you think also that the catalyst for the movement may have been, I mean, I think people were just so indignant when the banks were putting fees on the banks that had been bailed out, and they thought, we're citizens, we taxpayers are suddenly getting screwed by the banks again. And then suddenly, in light of the Supreme Court decision on corporations, I mean, I heard so much indignation on those two points particularly.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, small sparks can ignite a huge flame. I mean, it's amazing but really true that, you know, this one street vendor in Tunisia who set himself on fire sparked a massive conflagration that engulfed an entire region. And so I think Bank of America announcing a $5 fee on debit card transactions, though relatively insignificant in the scheme of things, was just such an insult given the state of affairs that I think it actually did spark things. And certainly the Citizens United case, even though it didn't really change much, I think was symbolically important too.
Glenn Greenwald, so good to have you on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here again. His book is With Liberty and Justice for Some. He'll be at Hillside Club in Berkeley this evening, 7:30. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.